Goeienaand, baie welkom by Sterre en Planete. Nou soos gewoonlik die eerste Sondag in die maand, het ons vir Jim Adams daar in Amerika hier by ons. Ons het vir Mati Hofman en Willie Koorts. Maar kom ons stel eers Lafra Smit aan die woord, want soos jy weet, het hy ook die gogga gehad en hy is nou vanavond saam met ons net om te kyk na die Junie hoogtepunte. Lafras.
Goeienaand Henny en goeienaand ook aan al ons luisteraars. Kom ons kyk gou na Junie maand se hoogtepunte en as ek so vinnig deur die lys kyk, gaan dit 'n redelike stil maand wees. Dit nou na Mei se besige maand met al die planeetkonjunksies en die maansverduistering, hoop ek baie van ons luisteraars kon dit gesien het. Dit was ongelukkig bewolk by my, so ek kon niks van hierdie besondere maansverduistering sien nie. Nou ja, al die planete se opleidings is vir nou eers verby en almal is nog steeds slegs vroeg in die oggende in die ooste te sien. Saturnus kom in die Junie heel eerste in die ooste op, eintlik nie eers meer in die oggendure nie, maar so net na 11 in die nag. So dit sal al hoog bo mense kop wees as jy vroeg die oggend net voor sonop sou kyk. Jupiter is dan volgende, gevolg deur Mars wat so net na 1 in die ooste sal opkom. Teen 4 uur sal Venus begin opkom, gevolg deur Mercurius, so teen 5 uur se kant. So die beste tyd om al hierdie planete te sien is so 0.5 uur voor sonop, waar hulle nog in 'n mooi lyn sal lê, alhoewel nie meer so naby aan mekaar soos vroeër in die jaar nie. Een datum wat julle kan merk, is om te kyk die oggend van die 26ste Junie, wanneer die maan saam met 'n helder Venus in die ooste sal wees. Saam met hulle sal jy ook die Pleiades of die sewe susters aan die linkerkant, asook die groot rooi ster Aldebaran aan die regterkant kan sien. So van helder sterre gepraat, nou vroeg saans so teen 7 uur net as dit nou lekker donker is, sal jy die helder rooi ster Arcturus in 'n noordoostelike rigting laag op die horison sien. Gewoonlik as die atmosfeer baie onstabiel is, sal hierdie helder ster mooi in kleure flikker. Draai dan wes, waar jy dan vir Canopus, Sirius en Poseidon laag op die horison ook sal sien. Ons is nou in die wintertyd en die skerpioen sal dan laag in die ooste wees as jy sou kyk. Op 21 Junie het ons 'n wintersonstilstand waar dit dan die langste nag en die kortste dag vir ons hier in Suid-Afrika sal wees. Die son skyn dan direk op die kreefskeerkring. So ja, redelike stil maand, maar nog steeds die moeite werd om na die kern van die Melkweg te kyk wat vroeg aand in die ooste sal wees en sommer mooi met die blote oog sigbaar sal wees vanuit 'n lekker donker plek. Ja, dis my storie vir hierdie maand. Tot volgende keer. Lekker opkyk almal.
Dankie Lafras. Nou ja, Jim sal jy onthou het die vorige keer hier by my in die ateljee gesit. Hy en Bianca en intussen het hy 'n lang tog onderneem deur Suid-Afrika, vol avonture. Jim, I think we should start with a little recap on your visit to South Africa. Would you try to do that?
Yeah, I will. I had a great time until the very end. I was in Cape Town, and then I went out to Berrydale, and I gave lectures to a math conference and in the Zico Planetarium. And when I was in Berrydale, I talked about space as art. And then I went up to Johannesburg and chaired a conference there. And took a little time, visited some friends in Limpopo, and came back down to Johannesburg and had some meetings. And then I went over to be with Mati in Bloemfontein and did a couple of lectures there. And we even had a braai. It was lots of fun. But my last night there at the Boyden Planetarium, I started to have a little scratchy throat, and I just figured it was because I'd been doing so much speaking. But by the time I got on the plane to go to the Transkei, I was not feeling well. And when I landed, I was still not feeling well. I went to bed for about 5 days at this wonderful resort in the Transkei, and ended up testing positive for COVID while I was there, even though I was vaccinated and boosted and wearing masks and all of that stuff. This Omicron is very contagious and held on. I think, I was I was saved from having to be in hospital just because of the vaccinations, I think. And I couldn't fly if I was positive. So a friend flew in from Johannesburg and we rented a car and took about 5 days to drive back from Transkei to Johannesburg, stopping along the way so each of us could rest. I got home and I've rested over the weekend and now I'm ready to do the recording for Stara and Planeta.
But Jim, it's just after all your visits to South Africa during, I think, the last 10 years or so, I think you had 15 visits so far. So you have quite a number of people you know quite well and friends that could in some way assist you during this difficult phase of your visit.
Yeah, indeed. It was lots of people helped me out. And I'm very grateful for it. You know, the South Africans are very hospitable folks. Not at all like they are in the United States, you know. So I was very happy that I was so well taken care of.
Now that's nice to hear. Right, the next subject is we've often spoken about SpaceX, but now Boeing has also been in the picture with their Starliner. Jim, what do you know about that?
Well, you know, when NASA let out the contract to SpaceX for the Crew Dragon to go between Kennedy Space Center and the International Space Station, they had also let out a contract to Boeing for Starliner. And the strategy was to create a little bit of market competition, have some redundancy. You know, if one company's vehicle went down, then we could maybe fly on a different vehicle. And so that was the plan. And last fall, I think, might have been December, the Starliner had some anomalies in their test program, and so they didn't fly. Oh, no, they did fly. I have that wrong. They did fly, but they were not able to to dock with the International Space Station. So they had to abort that. It had to do with thruster problems. And so last month, Boeing launched what they called OFT, Orbital Flight Test 2, and it was successful, but it had anomalies along the way, still more thruster problems. Two thrusters failed out of 12 that were designed to put the vehicle into orbit. And then while they were docking to the International Space Station, two of the maneuvering thrusters failed. And so I'm sure they're going to be scratching their heads on that. They did mate to the International Space Station. There were no crew aboard, by the way. This was an uncrewed robotic mission. And then they demated it 4 days later, and it made a landing in the New Mexico desert about 2 hours after separating from the International Space Station. So it was a good first step, and it's not dissimilar, to use a double negative, from the path that SpaceX followed. You know, when they started flying their Crew Dragon, they also had thruster problems. And so it's good to know how the mission could fail so that they can fix that in advance of putting people on board.
Jim, how do you decide whether to land in a desert or in the ocean?
Well, it has to do with the design. Originally, the two missions were both designed to land on dry land. And it's a stressor on the design of the system to land on dry land. The parachutes have to be different. There's a set of airbags that cushion the final descent. And structurally, it's a harder landing. So SpaceX, fairly early on, switched from a dry land landing to an ocean landing. Boeing did not. Boeing stayed with their dry land landing, but they have the capability of landing in the ocean as a backup if something goes wrong, you know, like bad weather or something.
Jim, I'm just curious about the accuracy with which they can determine where the landing will take place. because that will determine how quickly the astronauts can be picked up again. If the landing is on land, and to what extent can they prevent them from landing on a farmhouse or some agricultural structure or on a highway?
I don't have the actual accuracy numbers. I'd have to look those up. But the spot where they land is in New Mexico is the White Sands Test Range. And it's this enormous stretch of desert that I'm sure exceeds the size of the desert, exceeds by many times the accuracy of their ability to land a system. You know, they know pretty well from modeling and watching other landings to within several miles of where this thing is going to come down. And then the final descent, you know, they've got GPS, so they know pretty well exactly where it's going to land as it gets into the final descent. The things that cause the error is obviously unpredictable turbulence in the atmosphere, or maybe unaccounted for density differences and that sort of thing. So atmospheric conditions could shift the landing site, but not more than the size of the landing area. And same with the ocean as well, obviously. So they don't get too far off course.
Just another question, talking about the two contenders, SpaceX and then Boeing. Wasn't there a third contender as well to dock with the space station?
Yeah, but I believe they dropped out. Was that
Blue Origin?
Blue Origin, maybe. Yeah.
Okay, I looked at the video the other day of Ingenuity, the little Mars helicopter flying around, and while looking at this little video, I wondered what the rotation speed of the rotors are. Do you know, Jim?
Yeah, it's 2,800 RPM, which is pretty fast for a little tiny helicopter. But it needs to be that fast because the atmosphere is only a tenth as dense as it is here on Earth. So to get the lift they need, they have to have special blades that are pitched just the right size. And then obviously they want to spin it fast enough so they get the right kind of lift.
Yeah. I remember from the initial announcements, and there was one video I saw went into quite a length on the design of the rotor blades, and a lot of design went into it because, of course, there are lots of stresses, as you were just saying, on such a fast rotating object. So you had to, and that's why they had to make them so long. Or it was part of the equation, obviously, to get mm-hmm. enough lift, but also not to have to spin them too fast, because then they can disintegrate. They can actually pull themselves apart. So that was quite a sum they had to do to be able
Which
to
is
fly
the same.
In 1% atmosphere. Yeah.
They have the same problem with terrestrial helicopters as well. You know, the design of the blades, there's a lot of engineering that goes into the design of the blades. One of the cool things about the way they tested the Ingenuity helicopter is there's a vacuum chamber at Jet Propulsion Lab that it's usually intended, you put a spacecraft in there and you pull all of the atmosphere out so that you can see how it responds thermally. Because, you know, then with no air in the chamber, then the systems don't have that conduction to get rid of the
and
heat.
And convection disappears as well. No?
So then what they did with Ingenuity was they put it in that same chamber, and they offloaded it, meaning they put a little cable on the top of it to simulate the difference in the gravity between Earth and Mars. And so the cable went up over a pulley, and then there was a weight down the other side that would enable the the helicopter to go up and down with the simulated Mars gravity. And then they filled the chamber with 1% of atmosphere so that they could simulate the Mars atmosphere as well, which is not a usual way of using that chamber. But it seemed to have worked and proved the that the rotors on Ingenuity would work just fine.
Jim, I've just checked here that the rotation speed of the Ingenuity is about 5 times faster than for helicopters on Earth. So that's
a significant factor.
I'm just curious, it may not be a fair question, but if you say you are given a certain length for the rotors, say the specific design for the Ingenuity, and you would change the density of the atmosphere and to try to think for a given change, say a factor of 2, by how much you would have to change the rotation speed to give you the same lift. I can think that it's probably not linear, but do you have any feeling for that?
No, but I'm sure it would make a great exam question in a physics class.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking about, but I'm not going to take the memo.
Without knowing the exact answer, we're going to send Dragonfly to Titan, which has a different atmosphere, different density. It's thicker than Mars, and it's going to be a quadcopter. So they have to redesign the blades for that mission. And of course, and it's going to be much, much bigger than Ingenuity. Ingenuity weighs a couple of kilograms, and Dragonfly will weigh a ton. So it's going to be 1,000 kilograms. It's going to be quite different, but they are having to consider this same effect about the density of the atmosphere, the design of the blades, and that sort of thing. So it'll be a new design for those blades as well.
Do you think they will be able to have an experimental space in which they will simulate that atmosphere, analogous to what they did with Ingenuity?
Yeah, but they probably won't put the whole vehicle in it. They'll probably just test the blades.
I suppose just a recall or an update on Ingenuity's flight. We haven't spoken on the program for a while. As far as I know, it has done more than it is. It's already done its sort of 21st flights, and I think it's actually even more than that. And it has recently visited. It sort of took a shortcut to where the rover has got to go around, and it took a shortcut, and then it visited the parachute and the nose cone, or whatever is the right word. So it was the first time that they managed to see that, what happens to something like that once it's discarded. And I believe it's now overwintering. It's now stopping flying for the Mars wind.
Yeah, there'll be some winter operations, but yeah, they're going to change the operations. They had a communications problem with it recently, and they managed to get that fixed. So now they're going to switch to winter operations because the solar flux is lower. They won't be able to charge the batteries as fast, and a lot of the power that they collect will go into trying to keep the little thing warm over the wintertime.
Keep it alive.
Yes, Jim, we've often heard of the dust storms on Mars. How does Ingenuity handle that?
Well, it's probably the most equipped because one of you guys joked that it was a feather duster, right? But the idea is that if you can move air over the solar arrays, then you can get the dust off. And so I imagine they'll have some regularly scheduled flights for the Ingenuity so that they can keep the solar arrays clean. If you look at the pictures of the InSight lander, those solar arrays are just about totally opaque to solar radiation right now because there's so much dust on top of them and they have no way of getting it off. So that mission will ultimately stop working, most likely during the winter time.
I think I've read somewhere that because there's no moisture, or at least not a measurable amount around, the dust is obviously very, very dry. So the dust doesn't seem to stick as much as dust would on Earth, which does help to get rid of it by just some air movement.
That's true. And the Spirit and Opportunity rovers, which were solar powered, relied on dust devil season. These are little tiny tornadoes that would spin up the atmosphere in the regions of those two solar powered rovers. That's one of the reasons they were able to extend their missions for so long, is that they got a dusting from the Mars atmosphere every now and then.
What happens if there's a dust storm and Ingenuity is busy flying?
When it stops flying, it will collect dust. But if the storm is thick enough to block the sunlight, it will take Ingenuity some time to recharge as well. So they'd probably set it down, try and preserve as much battery charge as they can, weather the storm, and then once the sun comes out again, maybe take a flight to try and dust off the solar rays, or maybe wait, depending on how much charge they're getting from the sun, maybe wait to charge up the battery again.
Can they forecast a dust storm?
Well, they know when the dust storm seasons are, but our weather predictions on Mars are just starting to become mature. And so the kind of thick dust storm that caused Viking to delay its landing back in the 70s, they're still not fully predictable yet.
Jim, if the wind or the dust devil would tip the Ingenuity, is that something that can happen? I can't think about the reason that why it can't happen. Does it have the ability to get vertical again?
Yeah, so if it gets knocked over on its side, I don't think that there's going to be any way to right it. But the dust devils that happen on Mars are not like the tornadoes that you see on Earth, right? It's not like you're going to be sucked up into the sky. It's much more gentle, in large part because the atmosphere isn't as dense, and we already talked about that, right? So if you don't have the density, you have air particles moving fast, but they're it's a thin atmosphere. So
it's a few of them, yeah.
It'll be more like a gentle breeze than a tornado kind of storm.
Right, we have to watch the clock. Jim, you're on Facebook if people want to contact you.
I am. I love answering questions on the Sterra and Planeta Facebook group. Happy to do that.
En julle twee se besonderhede, Mati?
0836257154. 0836257154.
Is 0724579208. 0724579208.
En dan die program se e-pos is sterreplanete@gmail.com. sterreplanete@gmail.com. Ons is volgende week terug. Tot dan, alles van die beste.